Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening.
Yeah, hi.
And blessings. And welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of State. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5555.
Preston, you please begin the show?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, and I'm here, too. We want to welcome our audience to the Gist of Freedom. Tonight's guest is Dwight Zimmerman, author, here to talk about his book, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, The Hammer and the Anvil, and the End of Slavery in America. The book also features artwork by Wayne Van Zandt. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, thank you. And it's I'm very proud and honored to be a guest on your program.
Okay. Well, Mr. Zimmerman, can you tell us how you became interested in this project that brought about the book that you've written, The Hammer and the Anvil?
Okay. I had written a similar type of project on the Vietnam War called The Vietnam War, A Graphic History, also with artist Wayne Van Zandt. And not long after that book came out, my editor approached me and said that, asked me if I would be interested in writing a dual biography project on the intersecting lives of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And since I had written a variety of articles on assorted Civil War topics, so I did know in a general sense, their experiences. And as a writer of history, this was certainly something that, since I didn't know that much about, it piqued my interest, and I said, well, yes, I would certainly love to, if for nothing else, from a selfish reason of saying, I want to know more about what this was. And one thing led to another, and fortunately, Wayne Van Zandt was, his schedule was available, and we signed the contract, and I got the green light, and off I went.
So had you ever written about the Civil War prior to this book?
A little bit here and there. The articles that I had done were very, very specific. Battles, individuals, nothing, at all, in the scope of what you were talking about here, because, this story covers, well, not just the whole war, but obviously also their lives, from start to finish. And it was really an education for me. I knew broadly speaking, I knew about Lincoln's life. I knew very little, frankly, about Frederick Douglass's life. I knew a couple of the high points, obviously, but when you know, the difference between a general knowledge and then what you need to know as a writer, those are two completely separate things. And thus, as I delved into it, you know, working in the research and everything, boy, did I learn an awful lot.
Okay. Well, you know, before we get into the book, you might want to explain to our listeners whether you had written in this format before, and this book is formatted in the graphic format. Had you written
this
format?
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you for asking that. The listeners, I actually got my start at Marvel Comics, X-Men, Spider-Man, Iron Man, the company that did all those heroes, and in point of fact, in my salad days at the early start of my career, I wrote comic book stories about all those characters and a variety of others. And while at Marvel, one of the things that I kept talking to editors about was to say, hey, we need to do comic book stories, nonfiction things, history-based biography to introduce them to, history, because it, in point of fact, it's not just names and dates. Names and dates. Columbus discovered America in 1492. Yes. All right. Well and fine. But in point of fact, history is a very exciting thing because it's written, it's people do it.
Okay.
And I said, the visual medium of the comics field is ideal for this to get kids interested in history. But it never went anywhere. And it was only many years later with the, the rise of the graphic novels, the graphic biographies, the graphic histories, particularly with Helen Wang when they did the history of the 9/11 book a few years ago, that it opened a whole new chapter with regards to publishing and reaching out to everyone and saying the stamp of approval that yes, this works. And I'm so happy for that because I really see an awful lot of opportunity here to tell the story, important stories of histories, such as, Hammer and Anvil with Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And I hope to see so many more stories like this out there because there's so much history that needs to be known. And the stories are so interesting. And that I'm a part of this, I'm just so happy about.
I want to remind our listeners that if they would like to call in with a question or comment, the number was given at the top of the show. Another number that you might call is 949-270-5957. Mr. Zimmerman, what was your biggest challenge in telling this biographical story utilizing a graphic format?
I guess the biggest challenge was condensing things because, obviously I had a limited amount of pages and, the competition is between text and artwork. So what you're looking at is where are the real important points? Fortunately, I was in this period. This was an age of oratory.
Mm-hmm.
People, made many speeches. Letters were written. There's so much great documentation. So I had a lot of primary material that I was able to work with to tell the story. So at that point, it is going through all of these different documents, whether they were transcripts of speeches, letters, what have you, diaries, all manner of things. I mean, it was just almost an overload of material, and then having to winnow it down to where are the real important facts, the statements, to be said here and there. And I have to say that was really my biggest challenge, because I was dealing with such a wonderful wealth of material. And I can only hope that for, people who pick up this book, and they're seeing, they're reading this, I can tell them that, the important passages where you're seeing people making speeches, making their comments, and everything, I really did try and find that gem within the array of jewels. This was definitely not, trying to find the, the diamond, in the rough. But no, there were, it was so many well-turned phrases, so many great statements. I'm sorry, yes?
Excuse me. What resonated with you most about Abraham, Mr. Douglas's life, Frederick Douglass's life? What was one of those gems?
Oh, that is difficult to choose from, because he had so many stages. I have to say that, stepping back, when I assessed his whole life, it is his strength of character. And most importantly, as a kid, he went through some horrific experiences, witnessing abuse of slaves and then suffering abuse himself. And he didn't break. So everything that came from him in adult life was an extension of what he was able to achieve as a kid. So it was his strength of character as a child when you are the most vulnerable, because you don't have, the buttressing of experience and everything. And he's witnessing some horrific events and then having horrific things happen to him, the whippings and the beatings. And he stood up.
Yeah.
Perhaps not directly, but mentally. And I have to say that really resonated.
Okay. He ran away from slavery at a very early age.
Actually, he was an adult when when he left Maryland for the North. It's a fascinating story, because
can you share that story with us?
His masters were actually they were progressive within the context of the slaveholding era. They gave him a fair amount of freedom to associate with other blacks, Negroes back then, and there was it's one thing that I was not able to really detail, for space limitations, but there were essentially two classes of African Americans, during the slave period of the United States era. you had the free African Americans and you had the slaves, and often they, you know, intermingled.
Mm-hmm.
It's not widely known, you know, nowadays. And in point of fact, what happened was Frederick Douglass met this woman who was a free African American, you know, at a church, and she and he later became married, and she was instrumental in helping him escape from Maryland up to New England. And it's a fascinating story. They had a genuine love. They shared an interest in music. I forget right now. It was violins, and I forget what she did. I have to apologize for that. But they had a shared interest in music, and both were accomplished musicians. And one thing led to another, and they got romantically associated, and they realized that for them to have a life that he wanted to live, the only way that that could happen was if he escaped. So she was instrumental in assisting him to get a sailor's uniform, got him money to help bribe railroad conductors, and he managed to get up into the north to New England and start his second life.
Well, did they got married in New York City?
They got married in the north. It wasn't in New York City, because New York City was a very dangerous place for African Americans during that period. Because what's not widely known nowadays is that was a major hub for the slave trade. Even though technically importation of slaves was illegal, it was one of those situations where it wasn't that law wasn't enforced. In fact, it wasn't really enforced until the start of the Civil War, when a slave captain was brought up on charges in New York City, and the death penalty was brought down, and it was a huge topic on the news, newspapers and everything, and the petition for a clemency, went all the way up to Abraham Lincoln.
Okay.
And Lincoln...
Excuse me. We just got an email in wanting to know if you know anything about a David Ruggles. Is that name?
That name sounds familiar. Nothing comes to mind immediately, but I'm in front of my computer, so... let me see.
D-A-R-U-G-G-E-L-E-S. David Ruggles.
R-U-G-G-L-E-S. Hold on here. Now, bear with me. Oh, okay.
Okay, we can move on from that.
Yeah,
inquiring.
I'm seeing that now. No, he was not a... I did not mention him in the book. And, yes, I did see articles about him in my research, but this was a situation where, because of space limitations, I could not mention all of the different abolitionists involved. Obviously, I did have... some, particularly the ones who were more closely associated with Frederick Douglass. I had to keep a very tight focus on that sort of thing. Mr. Garrison and a few others who were instrumental in helping Frederick Douglass. I would like to do another story with all these other people, but the person who contacted raised a very good point, and it is my regret that no, I wasn't able to include him in this book.
Okay. Were there any black abolitionists in the book?
Well, aside from Frederick Douglass, no. There were a few, especially when Abraham Lincoln has that pivotal meeting with a variety of African-American leaders this is during the war, when he is trying to work out a consensus, because he was caught between so many different conflicting points, because fundamentally he's looking at it as saying, well, he wanted to preserve the Union, and most of the people in the North were all for preserving the Union. The slavery issue was a distant second, and he was really, at the start of the war, he was really in an awkward position, knowing that, yes, it will, the issue of what to do with slaves with regards to freeing them, their status, the whole nine yards. It was a thing he was constantly wrestling with. And not only just whether or not they would be accepted as citizens within the country, he was looking at perhaps colonizing, a la what happened in Liberia. And I write about that in my book on page 122. I have it right here. On August 14th, 1862, he summoned a group of five leaders of the Negro community in Washington, D.C. to discuss the matter. The group included Edward M. Thompson, John T. Caston, John F. Cook, Benjamin McCoy, and Cornelius Clark. It was historic occasion. For the first time, free African Americans who were not servants were meeting the president. And he lays the whole thing out. Lincoln says, your race is suffering the greatest wrong inflicted on any people. But even when
that suffering be on the poor whites who were mining the gold and wouldn't be able to do that if slaves were mining the gold? Did the gold rush have any factor in that?
No, not really, because what Lincoln is talking about here is, the whole fact of bondage. He really did not. He had witnessed. Early in his life, he had taken riverboats down to New Orleans, and he had seen the slave trade, the slave markets, and everything, and he came away with a hatred of the institution of slavery as a moral issue. So when he's talking about that, he's talking about the injustice of a human owning another human and abusing that thereof, in every respect possible. And he, recognizing the prejudices of the white community during that period, he is trying to find a solution. He's not offering answers. He's literally groping, and he's trying to work with every group possible. Evidenced by what I just said with this group, taking the extraordinary measure for that period of bringing this group of African Americans into the White House and laying everything on the table and saying, I want to work with you. Let's see what we can do to try and find a solution. And it's a messy situation. There's no two ways about that. And there's no cut and dry solution, particularly because this was in the middle of a war on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was really amazing to see how much Lincoln was, because he had, obviously, just dealing with, the battlefield situation and all of that. But he was looking beyond that, trying to grapple with a solution for this fundamental thing to...
Did universal suffrage play any role in this in terms of the poor and landless white men allowed to vote, or when were they allowed to vote?
Well, that is a part of this. This is not I don't dwell on that with my book. It is mentioned when we get into the part about the Civil War amendments, in which African American males receive the right to vote, and also African Americans were acknowledged as citizens. There were, the three Civil War amendments, which I believe are the 15th, 16th, and 17th.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on memory at that particular point. So, any of the listeners, if you're challenging me, on that, fair enough. But there were three, and they were all related to establishing citizenship for African Americans, granting African American males the right to vote, and eliminating slavery.
Okay. Do you deal with Bloody Kansas at all, and the role that that might have played?
Not really, because that was that was outside of things. John Brown was, is in the book, but that's only with respect to his meeting with Frederick Douglass prior to the Harper's Ferry incident. And so it's a tangential mention, essentially establishing who John Brown was. And, and then...
Can you tell us a little bit more about that meeting?
That meeting was obviously, those two people knew each other, and established a relationship. And they had two separate approaches to the whole abolition movement. Frederick Douglass tried to work within the system, and John Brown, his whole approach was tear it down. He took, basically, John Brown took a terrorist approach.
Yeah, John Brown was known as a radical abolitionist.
Yes.
I think there were three phases of abolitionists, and he was more of a radical abolitionist, whereas Lincoln might have been what they call the free soiler. That is the non-extension of slavery.
Slavery
could remain where it was in the state where it existed.
Lincoln was on record for, stating, he famously with his letter to Horace Greeley, he said, if I could preserve the Union by, keeping slavery, I would. If it meant some slaves would be freed and others would not, obviously I'm paraphrasing, standard was, he would accept slavery if it meant preserving the Union. If it meant partial freedom and partial slavery, he would accept that. And if it meant the only way it could happen is abolition of slavery, he would do that. His whole purpose was preserving the Union. And he was basically keeping his options open. What was so interesting when he wrote that letter, you know, about Greeley, to Greeley, he actually had already made up his mind to eliminate slavery. But he, you know, it was a private, it was a thing where he kept that secret. Yeah, here we go. And on page 126 of the book, I say, on August 22nd, Lincoln wrote a response, because Greeley, you know, was saying, let's get rid of slavery now. So he said, my paramount object in the struggle is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What
so
I do... almost done. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. Now, when Frederick Douglass read that, he said, he actually, initially he was disappointed, but he saw within it a germ of hope. And it was vindicated with the Emancipation Proclamation, and obviously we know what, you know, what ultimately happened there.
Right. Well, this whole westward expansion is probably what motivated the need for the Union to be preserved. I'm thinking of the Homestead Act. What role did that play?
Well, you're quite right about the westward expansion, because that is really the crux of the whole conflict. The South was scared. Yeah, they had within the original 13 colonies, you know, from Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, on down, you know, to Georgia, the original 13, and then Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Missouri.
Okay.
You know, they had slaves, but what, you know, with the expansion, you know, the acquisition of territory, that, you know, suddenly this, you know, the nation became a continental nation, and Southerners were seeing their way of life threatened. By their way of life, you know, we're talking the slaveholding interests, the plantations.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw a political power threat, and they were trying to, they were basically being very reactionary and obstructionist, trying to hold back as much as they could the acquisition of new states and trying to work out systems that would be, so for any free state, there would be a counterpart slave state. This is where we had the Bleeding Kansas, you know, in the Kansas-Nebraska, you know, scenario.
Okay.
It was a losing proposition, which they, the Southern politicians understood, because there was no way that they could export slavery into areas where, because of the climate and the land, slavery really wasn't practical.
Could you take a moment to explain the Homestead Act for our listeners?
Ah, The Homestead Act was one of the greatest acts ever passed by the United States government. What they wanted to do, and actually my grandparents took advantage of that. To settle the frontier, at its very basic core, it was so long. They would give you free and clear 160 acres of land and a mule if you settled there and farmed it. Basically set up your home and cultivated the land, in one form or another. And it was one of the most wonderful things that could ever, happen, because people who never had an opportunity, particularly in Europe, where people just didn't have a chance to purchase land, and they're hearing of this opportunity to own land without having to pay anything for it. Your only obligation is that you had to settle on it and live there for, I forget how many years at this point, but it was a set amount of time. And the land was yours. It was a great thing, and it helped to drive people into the West. It was such a wonderful opportunity for people from all walks of life. And we had these massive migrations that helped settle it started in from Ohio straight on through to California. Mm-hmm. And I'm just in awe in its impact, because it just it opened the doors for people of all walks of life, particularly those who didn't have any other means, and suddenly they became property owners, and it was a huge thing. I'm just so proud for our country, in that. In fact, the Homestead Act, people think that it lasted only in the 19th century, but it actually didn't end until the 1960s. Up in Alaska, there was the final Homestead Act claims were made in Alaska.
Okay. Were any such promises made to black folks in terms of the Homestead Act?
That gets complicated, because here we're talking Reconstruction, and that is beyond the scope of my book. And unfortunately, Reconstruction is a very sad chapter in our history. There were many admirable efforts and attempts and successes, but they were undercut by a lot of other efforts.
Moving back to the subject matter of the book,
mm-hmm.
Where did you see any common elements between the two lives, between Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln?
The most interesting one was the fact that in one respect, Lincoln was also a slave. Now,
was he now?
Yeah. With respect in this context, as a minor, his father could rent him out to various people, and the work that that Lincoln did, the income derived thereof, his father received. So, obviously, I don't want to, go too far along this line, but structurally, Lincoln, when you look at it from that standpoint, Lincoln was a slave. Now, once he reached his majority, then he was free and clear and could do whatever he wanted and was not beholden to his father. But until he reached his majority, he was, you know, his father controlled him much the same way that a slave master controlled his slaves. You know, there were, you know, some other limitations, but with respect to labor, you know, work, Lincoln was shackled in the same way that slaves were. And what I saw was that gave Lincoln an emotional connection to the African Americans in that respect.
What were some of the contrasts in the lives of these two men?
Well, the biggest one was the fact that, when you're talking about the American dream, where a person can pull himself up from their bootstraps and become whatever he wanted. Well, back then, yes, if you were white, that was entirely possible, and Lincoln is the epitome of that. But if you were black and tried to do the same darn thing, and a slave, you know, in the South, that was regarded as rebellious nature, and the slave owners would do everything they could to beat that out of you.
And for you, in writing this book and doing the research, what was the defining moment for you in this book regarding their meeting, Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln?
There are two. You know, the most famous one that is talked about is the first meeting between, you know, Douglass and Lincoln, but that was a private meeting. Though that's historically important and rightfully so, for what it was, that is a private meeting. The one that really defined it, you know, for me was a later public meeting, essentially celebrating the end of the, you know, of the Civil War, in which there is this celebration. It was actually, I'm sorry, it was following Lincoln's second inauguration speech on March 4th, 1865. And Douglass was in the audience listening to the speech, and that evening he attempted to go into the White House. And on page 140 and 141, you know, I write about that. He was part of the line of well-wishers to congratulate the president. Things were a lot simpler back then. You could actually go in and meet the president without the security arrangements that now exist, even though there were some back then. But when he got to the door of the White House, two policemen attempted to stop him. And Douglass said, "Hey, wait a minute. As I said, no such order could have emanated from the president." In other words, forbidding him from, you know, talking. And if he knew I was at the door, he would desire me admission. And word got to Lincoln that Douglass was there, and Lincoln ordered Douglass to be allowed in. And what happened was a public meeting between the two, in which Lincoln grasped Douglass by the hand, shook his hand very strongly, and said, "I am glad to see you. I saw you in the crowd today listening to my inaugural address. How did you like it?" Douglass, you know, said that he, okay, Douglass tried to prevaricate. "Mr. Lincoln, I must not detain you with my poor opinion when there are thousands waiting to shake hands with you." "No, no," said Lincoln. "You must stop a little, Douglass. There is no man in the country whose opinion I value more than yours. I want you want to know what you think of it. And Douglas said, Mr. Lincoln, it was a sacred effort. And Lincoln said, I am glad you liked it. This act was a public statement that black men, well, blacks, are equal to whites. Because here is the President of the United States shaking hands and talking with an African-American, soliciting his opinion, and you have surrounding the group the cream of Washington society, cabinet officers, generals, you know, a wide variety of people. You could not make a more public statement about what had to happen here. Here was a statement of equality, and that, for me, was a defining moment in this story.
Okay. Now, moving back to the slave owners and, you know, back in that day, only people that owned land and slaves amounted to about 1%, and they were the only ones that had the right to vote. Is that correct? Poor whites obtained the vote after the Civil War?
Well, no, whites did have it. It's just that the slave owners, the plantation owners, had extraordinary power. This is where we get into the three-fifths clause in the Constitution, where...
Was that in the Constitution, or was that a Supreme
Court?
No,
that was in the Constitution, yes. When, in 1787, during the framing of the Constitution, the most contentious, most contentious topic was, how do we account for slaves with regards to voting? Because the South, which had slaves, one of them counted, and the North, which basically didn't, said no. Because it was a power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And the compromise was that for voting purposes, slave owners, and here was where the massive hypocrisy. So, slave owners could count three-fifths of their slaves. So, for every five slaves that they owned, three counted as voters. But the blacks could not.
Did you say three counted as voters?
Well, yes. For voting purposes.
For voting purposes. Gotcha. Go ahead.
Right. But the blacks could not vote. What that meant was that the owner of the slaves, so this was a classic case of, no, this is not one man, one vote. This was one man who happened to own X amount of slaves. It was his vote plus three-fifths of however many slaves he voted. So if he had 100 slaves, for instance, then it was his vote plus 35.
His vote plus 35, okay. So yep. Could a landless person vote?
A landless person could vote so long as he was white, but that was just one vote. So you see the obvious inequity, in that, if... in that sort of situation where, plantation owners who had their self-interest, if they stood behind a particular, measure, well, it wasn't just, plantation owners versus the landless people. It was plantation owners plus their slave vote, which they held because the slaves couldn't vote, and they could ram through any, measure that they wanted. It was really lopsided. And
so when was the requirement removed for property owners only? Or was that ever an issue?
Okay, that is a completely separate thing because that gets into the various civil rights acts. That gets into the Jim Crow laws. That's that's really, you know, post my story. Yeah, you raise a very good issue, and I do touch on it very briefly at the end. But yeah, the point there was that the real key, you know, began with the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling by the Supreme Court in 1896. That was a separate but equal, and that really opened the door for all the other Jim Crow laws that kept designed to keep African Americans disenfranchise them and make them second-class citizens. And it was not until Lyndon Johnson, a Texan no less, and a Democrat, with the Civil Rights Act in 1864 and 1865, that finally ended legally, all of that injustice.
So officially, when were poor white landless men allowed to vote?
Oh, they always had the right to vote. That really was not an issue. If you're talking about that part of it, it was, are you white or are you slave? Even if you were free black, you still couldn't vote. Yeah, it was a whites-only vote. So that issue was more, if you were poor or white, you had one vote. If you were rich and in the South particularly had a lot of slaves, you had, for all practical purposes, more than one vote.
Okay, there seems that there is some disagreement on that particular issue. But moving along, what impact did Lincoln's death have on Frederick Douglass and the issue of emancipation?
It was probably the saddest part of that, because it rendered the whole issue of emancipation incomplete. Lincoln, far and away, was the greatest champion for that, and he was the only one with sufficient stature to fight back against the arrayed interests that wanted to keep African Americans as second-class citizens, because there were two issues here. One was freeing the slaves, and the second one was equality of the African Americans. Racism was rampant in the North, and that was a big thing that Lincoln recognized. And he went on record saying he actually felt that it would take about 100 years for equality to accrue to African Americans, and he was basically right.
Plus 300 years, maybe.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, I'm not in a position to go into detail there, but he was very prescient in taking the long view of how it would take a lot of time for white people's attitudes to change. The upshot here is that I'm sorry. It's such a complex thing that I don't know if I can adequately comment on it. There were so many aspects of telling the story where I was going. I struggled. I said, "How can I tell this story, this particular piece of it, properly?" Stepping back from it, I said, just writing this was an extraordinarily humbling experience, mm-hmm. because I recognized the burden of really trying to do the right thing, recognizing that at any point I would stumble and fail. And all I can, tell, the listeners is that I did my best. I only ask you to read it, read the book with an open mind. I hope that what the story I've been able to tell resonates, and is factual. If you see any error in there, I certainly apologize for that. But I tried to do the best I could to tell both Douglas's and Lincoln's story and the end result. With Lincoln's death...
From what I can see, this is probably the first effort made in that direction that I can tell. And while we're on that, give the listeners some information on where the book is available. How can you be contacted, your contact information, should they want to get in touch with you on where to get the book, what the price of the book is, et cetera?
Oh, it's available on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com. You can order it through your bookstores. It is $24.95. And, anyone who wants to get in touch with me, I have a Facebook site. You can contact me through that, or you can contact me. My email address is djonzim@gmail.com. That is djonzim@gmail.com. And I have to say that I have... been getting some very enthusiastic response from the library market. I have been invited to Brevard County for their 25th. They have a literary festival, and this is the 25th year for that. And I have been asked to be a guest author for that event that's happening in March. I have accepted that. The Kansas City Public Library System has asked me to come.
Oh, you're coming to my hometown, huh?
Yes. So we're working out the details for the exact date there, but I'm looking forward to that. And, Preston, I hope I see you there.
I'll be there.
And there's other contacts that are available. I am just so thrilled, to hear that kind of response, because – really, this is an important story, and I tried to tell it well. And obviously, once it goes out there, well, that's what you readers, tell me, whether or not I did it right.
Okay. We're coming up and getting a little short on time here.
Mm-hmm.
After Lincoln's death, in what way did Douglas's life change for him personally?
Sadly, it changed his life for the negative. With regards to who he was on the personal side, he had a respected position. No one was really going to challenge him. But in the larger, story about working toward equality for, African Americans, the loss of Lincoln really removed the most important figure in that respect. And Douglas, once the amendments were passed, eliminating slavery, giving African-American males the right to vote and everything, that pretty much ended Douglas's efforts. He devoted his whole life to that end. And from that point on, you needed the next generation of individuals to carry the torch, as it were. So he became an elder statesman, but unfortunately... without the authority figure of Lincoln to help support him, the tenor of the times, the prejudice, you know, of whites and everything, that worked ultimately against him and the African American community, and they just got more and more marginalized, you know, ultimately leading to that devastating decision which I mentioned earlier, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, the separate but equal, and that just, you know, it, you know, opened the floodgates for a new set of discrimination codified by a Supreme Court ruling that wouldn't end until, wouldn't start to end, I should say, until Johnson signed the Civil Rights Acts, you know, in the 1960s.
In the 1960s, yeah. This format I find very interesting. What's your opinion now on using the graphic format for telling these kind of histories and biographies and whatnot? I think it's a great thing for kids. I think it'll strike their interest and make it easy for them to read. But what's your opinion on that?
I agree with you. You know, I view it as an important first step. No, by no means do I say that this is definitive. But what my whole approach has been, it opens the door. It gets, you know, it exposes them to the varying things. The format does not allow you to get into the depth and detail that a regular textbook does. However, it makes it accessible. You know, the combination of visuals and text, it is very kid-friendly, and that's really the important thing. Get them interested in the story, you know, that history is not just simply a dry thing. They need to know so much, and here what I'm hoping is that it makes it accessible.
Okay. I think we're going to have to close. We're just about out of time. Well, we're out of time. And I want to thank our guest, Mr. Dwight Zimmerman, for coming on and sharing his information on his book, The Hammer and the Anvil, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, and the End of Slavery in America. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman, and I hope to see you when you visit here in Kansas City.
Thank you, Preston. I'm so happy, and I look forward to seeing you and shaking your hand.
Great. I'm looking forward to that. Okay, good night. Well, quite an interesting topic here on The Gist of Freedom. I'm your host, Preston Washington, and we just finished our discussion with Mr. Dwight Zimmerman, who is the author of The Hammer and the Anvil, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, and the End of Slavery in America. I'd also like to thank Leslie Gist for making this show possible. And I hope you'll tune in the next time to hear what it is we have to say about African American history here in the United States, all over the world for that matter. Take care, folks. See you next time.